Always record 186. So this is all Dennis's fault. Who's here?
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm pretty good.
Who's on here? Two of eight.
I just restarted the previous, so.
Okay.
So that means that it might just be you right now.
Oh, okay. Who is this? Not on this call.
Not on this call.
Alan, Alex, Dennis, MK Ultra, SJ, William. What were we saying? It's all Dennis's fault.
That's what I said. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny today. Alan called, and he's like, "I had this urging to watch Barry Lyndon," and then I saw that's what you guys were watching, but I don't think I'm going to watch it. Well, you can still play. I want to play, but I have things to do.
Yeah, I just watched it again last night.
Well, it's funny because I got to chatting with him, and I didn't finish the movie.
Oh, okay.
I got pretty close, not close enough.
When did you finish?
I was watching right up until I just called you, and so I have about 40 minutes left, I would guess.
Oh, okay. So what's happening then?
He's buying his son a horse, and Lord Bullington has kind of disappeared for the time. I mean, it's so funny because this is another Kubrick film in which, man, I don't know what the hell's going to happen. Like, nothing? Something?
This one is a bit strange because the narrator tells you what's going to happen.
Oh, you're right. Is Brian going to die?
Yeah, well, that's what he says. He says that Barry's destined to leave the world childless.
And penniless, too, right?
Penniless, yeah.
But it's funny because the narrator is such that I kind of just... He's drony and I tune him out. I mean, I listen. It's like you know how when you read... is it Greek tragedy? Where it tells you exactly what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And then it's just kind of like just a thumbnail summary of what's going to happen. An episode in which Odysseus fights a cyclops and all his men die. Something like that.
Yeah.
And you I don't know, for some reason I don't really take it in. But you're right. He told you exactly what's going to happen. So what happens? Spoil it for our audience, even though it looks like no one else is going to play this time, and it's all Dennis's fault.
Wait, how is it Dennis's fault, though?
I feel like it was his idea to do Barry Lyndon.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, so you're thinking that people didn't like Barry Lyndon so
I don't know what I'm thinking, because it seemed like people were into it. Maybe they're still into it. Well, I need to go back into... I'll see if I can find some people here. You know?
Yeah.
SJ sounded like he was...
Oh, wait.
Pretty,
yeah. But... Except he said it was 4 a.m. where he's at.
Oh, okay.
So that would be the... I didn't realize... I thought the last time we talked, he was...
He was in Thailand, which would be close to my time, but he's back in Europe or something.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, surprised Alex is not on here. It's another Kubrick.
Yeah,
this one gets mixed reviews, so, right?
Well, so, all right. So what I told Alan earlier was I kind of came to a realization, and I guess that is an understanding of why Always Record was what Always Record was. And that is, for me, I used to speak about the Holy Trinity. And the Holy Trinity, and this was kind of tongue-in-cheek, was this idea of Led Zeppelin, Lord of the Rings, and Dungeons and Dragons. And they all kind of really played nice together. So, I mean, you definitely had like a Ramble On. That song is actually about when the party leaves Rivendell, you know? So all those, and so that kind of definitely kind of described my own childhood and headspace somewhat. And so I definitely was, for me, I appreciated Pink Floyd, but I really never got into those depths. But, you know, I guess just recently I started thinking about it, and it's like, oh, it's Kubrick and Pink Floyd and maybe like McKenna or even just straight up LSD. Like that's kind of that world that Always Record really kind of, I mean, I also appreciated Kubrick, but man, to really, you could lose yourself in those depths. And so,
well, I guess that was me too. that's perfect. I went from one to the other. Maybe that was my high school.
Well, so I don't know. I mean, I know you, but I don't really know you. How old are you, Snor?
I'm probably the same as you. Like, when were you born?
72.
So I was 71.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, and so my father the paperbacks for The Lord of the Rings and Dune and like a lot of those classic books were laying around in my childhood, but he wasn't like a giant music fan, and so a lot of the classic albums I didn't really, like, I found on my own.
Yeah, that was me too, because it was really when I went into high school, I started hanging out with all these guys who were about 3 years older than me, maybe 3 or 4 years older than me, and then they all had older brothers and sisters who tapped into that stuff directly in the 1970s, like the later albums, and then from the later albums we went into the earlier stuff, and then it's exactly what you said, like getting into like Led Zeppelin is a bit more approachable, and then Pink Floyd, and then that's why I completely got into Pink Floyd, especially the earlier stuff. The first time I dropped acid was in high school, and I listened to Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And I was convinced, like on a Walkman, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was convinced that every single note or sound was perfect, you know. I still think that. Yeah.
But so that was on acid.
That was on LSD, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you're right. Like that's when I was really into Kubrick as well. Actually, Barry Lyndon was the only Kubrick videotape that I had for some reason. You know, so I watched it multiple times. I guess I probably watched Barry Lyndon more than any other Kubrick movie. But up until last night, I hadn't watched it for a long, long time. But I'm still pretty blown away by it. I can't remember exactly why I had it on videotape. Like it. I think I recorded it off of TV or something like that, but it just happened that was the only one I had. But I watched all the rest with my friends who had that on tape, or we rented it or something.
Well, what did you make of it this time?
I thought it was amazing. Like it was better than I thought. You know, I was watching it late at night because I had to wait for the kids to go to bed and everything else. But so I was kind of lying down, and I was just on the verge of drifting off in the middle of it. Then I sat up, and then I got up a bit, and then I started watching it again, and then I got really into it. And so, beautiful movie. You know, like just to watch it.
Well, it's interesting how my own. Okay, so this movie is definitely kind of a, like, you just, it seems like it's the course of chance. His whole life is just taking place, you know, one event leads to the next event, kind of, and you just, yeah. Well, but so that's kind of my own trip through this too, in that, you know, so SJ was talking about where he was and what he's doing, and he was asking questions about, like, the Austrian Empire a little bit. Right. He was talking about Vienna, and he was talking about Mozart. And so in high school, I was into the movie Mozart, the Amadeus or that Amadeus film. And so I was wondering if that film wasn't inspired somewhat by this film, even though that film came out maybe 10 years or more than 10 years later. But
yeah, it could be.
Anyway, I mean, so it's just interesting because from that conversation, it reignited me to think about Slavoj Žižek a little bit more.
Huh.
And I listened to a bunch of his podcasts between that time. And so I was thinking about the idea of film. There's a, you know, the idea of the ideology that the director's conveying. So, like, there is something the director's trying to say through the story, but there's also the idea of what film does through visual storytelling. And this is definitely like a visual storytelling film.
Right.
In that, you know, he's purposefully really thinking about these wide shots that he's zooming out on, and there's just more and more details that come up as he zooms out.
Yeah, apparently he's only using natural lighting, or that was the sort of mythology behind the film. I think he actually did use some artificial lighting eventually, but he tried. I think he did try his best just to use natural lighting, including just candlelight.
Yeah, and so, like, that is definitely something that you recognize, because and it makes you wonder what life was like in a world where you only had candlelight.
Yeah, you watch those scenes, and all of these aristocrats are just walking around the garden, basically, in their fancy dress, and they don't seem to be doing much more than that, you know. but I noticed that here in Japan too. Like, we've gone to Japanese gardens where they sort of recreate the old houses that people used to live in, and like aristocratic houses, beautiful gardens, but inside the house there's hardly any furniture at all. It's just tatami mats, like straw mats, and they would just sit and watch the garden for hours, you know, like a completely different headspace. And I got the sense, again, watching this movie this time, is that maybe that was happening in Europe too, to some extent, you know.
Well, the other thing I think about is, like, the class of story that is being told, and what the, you know, to what purpose that is. And so it seems like there's lots of middle-class stories, but it seems like there's some of these more classic things are definitely like upper-class stories, or people changing ranks from class to class. And I just wonder, like, I'm starting to think about, like, what is motivating Stanley Kubrick to tell the stories that he does?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like it might be something like in classical writing in general, like I guess all the way up to the modern period, novels, not only novels but plays, everything, operas, were written about the upper classes, right? It wasn't until the modern period that that kind of changed. It kind of flipped, and then more and more people are just writing about average people, even really lower class people become more popular in novels. But it almost seemed like this movie, Kubrick, is showing that flip, you know, where the a person of the lower classes, or I don't know if he's entirely lower class, Barry Lyndon, what's his name, Redmond Lyndon, Redmond Barry in the first part.
Well, they definitely were on, so, you know, at the beginning of the film, the family needed that marriage.
Yeah. So they're kind of, middle class. Farmers, or, yeah. And so it's his kind of rise to the aristocracy and then the fall from it. Like it's an unsuccessful journey from the middle class to the aristocracy. And that there's this, I don't know if you got to that part, probably you did, but there's a part where the narrator says the kind of mentality that it takes to rise to the aristocracy and to gain a whole, I think he said to gain a fortune, the type of mentality it takes to gain a fortune is almost entirely the opposite type of mentality it takes to preserve your fortune, you know, because then it just becomes bureaucracy, right? It just becomes accounting after that. And Barry Lyndon was, he's an adventurer, right?
And I mean, I definitely took note of that scene because of, the bureaucratic moment where he's just sitting there with all the bills piled up at the desk.
Right.
And I love it when you are able to see that a lot of things change, but some things don't ever change, that it's just the rooms that change. Like, it's the same shit that everyone deals with, where you've got your desk and you've got all the bills piled up and you're just like, what am I supposed to do with all this stuff?
Yeah. His wife is just sitting there signing that's all she's doing, signing these forms.
Yeah. Her makeup was really interesting in that scene because it seems like it wouldn't be out of place now. Like in 1975, maybe that was, because I don't know if I'm sure Stanley Kubrick attempted authenticity. It wasn't like stylized, but right. maybe it was. It's hard to know unless I did like some deep research. But it definitely seemed like he was trying to convey this. You know, if he was going for natural light, there's something he was after, authentically.
Well, he. You read about the background, just the general background of him making the movie, right?
No.
This is where we should have David, because I think he's looked into this a lot. But he was wanting to make a movie on Napoleon. And there was another movie that came out just before that point or something. And it kind of, it was called Bonaparte or something. And it flopped. And so a lot of the backers that Kubrick had to make this movie Napoleon pulled out, and so he wasn't able to do Napoleon, but he had done tons of research on this period piece that he wanted to do around that time. Like Barry Lyndon would be set a bit prior or almost the same time. Like Barry Lyndon ends in 1789 with the French Revolution, so depending on where he's starting with the Napoleon story, it's probably his early life, which is around the same time. So he had already done all this research of that period. And so he takes all of that knowledge and puts it into making Barry Lyndon. So it's got this interesting connection with Napoleon to it.
Right. And so you think it was just the next best thing.
Yeah. He wanted to do a... I was just reading this on Wikipedia, I think. But he wanted to do a movie on Vanity Fair by Thackeray first. And then there was like this television miniseries or something that had just come out on Vanity Fair. So he decided to do something else, and then he found this one. It was, as far as I know, yeah, he was trying to be as authentic as possible, and that's one reason why this film gets praised so highly, is that he was able to do it. It's almost like you're zapped back in time. Everybody with those painted on moles and
right.
beauty spots and you know. The aristocracy looks like a bunch of mutants, right? Like a bunch of aliens.
Yeah, and so it couldn't help. I mean, I thought of the Villa Venuses. I mean, so it just
exactly right.
It seems so, like, so over the top that it's almost, yeah, you know, like the kind of stuff you would see more in Eyes Wide Shut, the kind of like depraved arena.
Yeah, it reminded me of Clockwork Orange too. It's kind of a Clockwork Orange is a similar thing, which is just a young man who just gets led along by fate, right? He does take some actions into his own hands, but it's kind of like it's a similar thing where he gets led along and he gets sort of abused by the authorities in the same way that Barry Lyndon does.
Although I think I definitely feel more sympathy for the protagonist of Clockwork Orange, whereas this guy, I don't know that I liked him.
Yeah, well, I can see that. I kind of liked him. He seems human, you know, as opposed to all the other aristocrats. Like he's human. He's down to earth. He's passionate, right?
It's funny because I mean, the movie's long enough that you kind of lose your place in it. But I forgot that. So it starts off with this, and maybe that's where Dennis started with, you know. So he's. He's in love with his cousin, and then he's unwilling to let go of that when this officer from the army, you know, wants to date her or whatever you call that, or he wants to marry her, and it just these moments that are happening right on top of each other where he's, you know, unwilling to unwaver in his affection for his cousin.
Right.
And that really sets the whole thing in motion.
Yeah, there's all this, the kind of major theme of the duel all through the movie as well, right? Like his father, it starts off, his father dies in a duel, and then Barry gets into the duel with that army officer, John Quinn, and then he joins the British Army and has a big fighting match with the guy that challenges him. And all the way through, you didn't see the last of it, you wouldn't have seen the last duel. I don't want to spoil it. It's great at the end.
You could spoil it.
Well, okay. So his son dies, right? Brian dies.
Does he die of like a disease, or is it a tragic accident?
It's an accident. His father, Barry buys him a horse for his 9th birthday. Somehow, Brian finds out about it. Somebody tells him, and then both of his parents tell him never go to the horse. Promise me you'll never go to the horse and try to ride it without your father being there. And the kid promises. But before his ninth birthday, he sneaks out. He rides the horse. He gets thrown from the horse. The horse goes wild. He gets thrown across a field and ends up paralyzed. And then finally he dies of his injuries. And it's very, very sad. And both of his parents are devastated. Barry Lyndon takes to drinking heavily, and he ends up passing out over his in his house all the time. His mother sends servants in to pick him out of his armchair and stuff. And his mother becomes completely depressed as well. And she becomes closer and closer to the reverend, the Reverend Runt, you know?
Yeah.
So eventually Barry's Irish mother takes over the whole estate because nobody else everybody else is completely depressed and not doing anything. So she takes over the entire estate and ends up firing Reverend Runt because she thinks that Mrs. Lyndon is too heavily dependent on him, and he's a big reason of her depression. And so he leaves angrily, meets up with Lord Bullingdon, the older son,
yeah,
who's out of England. And so they make a conspiracy together with the accountant to basically take over the estate again. And so Lord Bullingdon goes to the estate, goes up to Barry, who's passed out in his easy chair, and challenges him to a duel, which they fight. And Bullingdon's a completely inept and completely a coward. He has first shot. Like it's shot on shot. So you get one shot. One antagonist gets one shot, and then the other person gets another shot. And when one shot. So he flips a coin. Bullingdon flips a coin. He gets to shoot first. Misfires his gun, shoots into the ground, and then it's Barry's turn. And Barry, to be magnanimous, fires his gun off to the side without hitting him. And then the seconds give Lord Bullingdon the chance to say that he's already achieved satisfaction and that he can walk away from it. But he doesn't. And so Bullingdon raises up his gun, shoots him, hits him in the leg. Barry gets the bones of his leg underneath his knee shattered, severs the artery, so he has to lose his leg. And then meanwhile, and so he's taken to an inn. A doctor has to amputate his leg below the knee. And his mother comes to visit him. And then the accountant comes to the inn and tells them that Lord Bullingdon has taken over the estate and that you can either stay in England and get arrested because you're so far in debt and all your creditors want their money back, or else we will give you a 500 guinea or pound, I guess, guinea or pound annuity. So every year you would get 500 pounds or whatever if he stays out of England. And so Barry, who's by this point he's devastated, so he leaves. You know, he leaves with his mother, and then that's basically the end of the story.
1975. Did it win awards?
I'm not sure if it did. Yeah, it wasn't. I don't think it was as well received as his other films, for sure.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have guessed that he made that late, I guess. But, I mean, so in looking at his filmography, you know, I was saying the Kubrick voice, and that was me, my way of trying to understand, like, his humor, but then also his kind of quirky stories that... that typify what I think of as his work.
Hmm. Yeah, apparently the book by Thackeray, which I've never even come across at all, is humorous. It's supposed to be a funny story, but that's one way that Kubrick changed it, is that it's not, it's this is not really funny at all. What did you mean by his humor in other movies, like in Strangelove?
Strangelove definitely seems like it's not straightforward. I guess 2001 is
pretty serious.
Yeah, pretty serious. Clockwork Orange is more quirky, like Strangelove.
Lolita is pretty funny at times.
Yeah. Definitely was quirky. But I mean, with that one, I definitely felt the same way, where I didn't know where the story's going. You're just kind of being led along, like the characters, through the adventure. The Shining, it's also
quirky. It's got some dark humor to it.
Yeah. And then I've never seen Full Metal Jacket. I'm aware of it. But so I picked up on his... I mean, war is definitely one of his major themes.
Right.
Maybe not. No, it definitely has to be Spartacus and Paths of Glory and Strangelove, Full Metal Jacket.
This idea of the game, you know, the duel or the game comes in a lot of his films, I'm thinking, as well. Like, especially in Barry Lyndon, it's all the way through. Like, he's not only the duels, but he's also gambling all the way through. It's all these games of chance. And it almost seems like life is a game of chance. You have this similar thing in 2001 with the chess game, the famous chess game between... with Hal and Frank, right?
Yeah.
Hal cheats. So it's similar in Barry Lyndon, the Count Body Body, or whatever that guy's name is.
Yeah.
A couple of cheaters, right? They're cheating everyone. So well that nobody knows how they're being cheated.
But then, yeah, they're doing it to get those people of wealth in there, like on the hook to them. You know, they're not necessarily trying to make tons of money. They're just, they want the wealthy people to owe them.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And so all they have is. The narrator describes it as some fancy clothes and a few trinkets, and that's why he decides to try to marry into the aristocracy.
Yeah. I wanted to mention, so there was something really beautiful about the big wide angle battle scenes from that.
Oh yeah.
18th century perspective with muskets and the bayonets, where they're just brutal. It's really brutal, but there's
just the kind of senseless formality of it too, right? Like just advancing step by step and letting your enemy fire on you without firing back until you reach their lines, and then you open fire on them, you know?
Yeah.
It's insane, like that. So yeah, it's kind of depicting warfare as a game as well. Like warfare has its own rules that, that both sides agree to.
Yeah. You were talking about LSD and Pink Floyd. It's funny. When was it? I don't know. I hadn't used any substances for a really long time, and then I was just kind of goofing around with marijuana a little bit, but that was, it was like, oh, I think marijuana in 2001, that makes a lot of sense to me. Let's give that a shot. So, yeah.
What happened?
I don't know. You hear more than what you normally perceive. It just seems like, oh, and that's something I definitely wanted to bring up. You were talking about Nabokov's idea of, like, what did you say? A radical surface? Like a now...
Yeah. You start, well, the texture of time, right?
That's informed by, you know, the past. There's just...
Yeah.
Just kind of this compression of everything into the current moment, which, like, I feel like psychedelic drugs actually somehow create more space for that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you just start noticing all the little details that normally you censor out of your perception.
Exactly. But of course, depending on what, you know, what you're trying to achieve, like if you're just trying to stay alive running through the underforest, marveling at the blades of grass won't necessarily do you any favors, but...
Oh, well. I don't know about that.
If you're not trying to get eaten.
Oh, yeah, I see. Well, yeah. Who knows? Like, yeah, if that's the way to go, then that's the way to go.
But I've been thinking about it in terms of like synchronicity and how science informs the zeitgeist, or how that the scientific paradigm somehow informs, like, the lens that we view the world through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even in terms of media, of course.
I guess I've been thinking a lot about, like, the idea of the quantum paradigm.
Mm.
And so, I think recently, it must have been, like, after The Texture of Time, I started reading this book by an Italian physicist, I think, called Reality's Not What It Seems. But, like, really laying out what quantum theory is. And so, and it's a beautiful book because he just loves the laws of nature. But, like, the idea that quantum means that things are granular, that there is... like fundamental building blocks, but things are indeterminate.
Mm.
You know, like there really is an indeterminacy to things. You can't pin anything down, and that everything is relational, so that unless there's a relationship, there's nothing. Like there's nothing to report unless you do have two characters interacting. I always turn it into like a literary type deal, and you probably shouldn't do that, but it's just...
Well, keep going. Yeah, I have a thought on that, but keep going.
No, I mean, that's kind of it. I'm, you know, just trying to understand, like, synchronicity and this, like...
I kind of think... science is always behind, you know, like what you just said, something that's relational, like these quantum particles or whatever are indeterminate and relational, etc., right?
Yeah.
Fuzzy, basically. that's language, you know. That's language in words. It is literary, you know. I always have this feeling that eventually science is going to reach to the point where it realizes that it's not based on numbers at all or anything quantifiable. It is based on language, you know. That's the best paradigm for describing what the universe is made of, you know. And it makes more sense than anything else because the universe is always subjective, you know. We can pretend that we see it from above or something in some sort of Archimedean height or objective heights or whatever, but we always experience it subjectively, like phenomenologically, right? And because of that, it's all bound up with language, you know. It's like that's how our senses operate, through language. We sort of encapsulate the world through language. So I think I think like I'm no scientist, right? But I think that literature and poetry, especially, where language is condensed so highly, you know, and meaning is condensed so highly, that it describes the universe better than anything else, you know.
I mean, so that kind of speaks to a thought that I've been having. Is this? It seems like there's this interface between science and basically media criticism that I'm interested in, but like, and that's kind of that space where yeah, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Yeah.
Are you talking McLuhan?
Oh, interesting. No, I'm just like that science generally, the practice is to start from a place of unknowing and build an experiment to learn something.
Yeah.
But it seems like in our like mediated world at this point in time, you start with a supposition that you believe to be true, and then you go and find things to prove this thing to be true. So like you're starting from a place where I have a theory. And in science, you know, it's more like I have a hypothesis. I'd love to build it into a theory, but I need to do some experiments before we can get there.
Right. What's that thing by Robert Anton Wilson? Like the I forget what it is. The prover proves, you know, like the person who wants to prove something ends up proving what they intended to prove. You know,
the
universe is so flexible that it accommodates you, right? if you go looking for it, you'll find it.
Well, confirmation bias, I think, is what they call it in like journalism, maybe.
I guess, yeah. That term seems to belittle it.
But I know what you're saying too. I mean, so like that was one of the thoughts where I think Rupert Sheldrake is saying that the laws of nature are flexible.
Yeah.
And that they can change over time or, you know, morph into, which, so like that's like another side. You know, like the power of positive thinking and that whole new thought spiritual realm.
Right, yeah.
With Neville Goddard and...
Yeah, the, what is that called? The, not the vision, what is that?
The secret. The secret, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah, here it is. Whatever the thinker thinks, the prover proves. So, there's actually a book by C.S. Lewis, nonfiction, called The Discarded Image. And he's talking about the kind of classical and medieval worldview of the crystalline spheres of the planets, right? And the music of the spheres and the four elements and how that model, although it was proved to be completely inaccurate, right, gave people this entire cosmos of meaning that they were placed within, right at the center of, right? Like, not as a peripheral random blip, you know, but right at the exact center of it. I think what C.S. Lewis is trying to say is how marvelous that is, like how amazing that would be to be alive when that is kind of the paradigm that everybody thinks. It's suffocating too in a way, and that's why people like Bruno wanted to break out of it, right? It's oppressive, it becomes oppressive and suffocating, but in a way it's something that it's hard to even imagine, you know, like even if you're brought up like I was, like in a Christian household, right? Like a fundamentalist Christian family. And there's sort of meaning built into that. But in the background, there's always this contradiction between those beliefs that your family has, right, that they're finding from the Bible, and then the kind of mainstream scientific paradigm that is the cause for all the technology that you're that you're living with and within, you know. So there's this huge contradiction in your conscious and subconscious mind, which wouldn't be there in that sort of classical and medieval paradigm, right?
Right. And I've heard it said that, like, when you maybe it was I listened to a read and listened to a lot of Joseph Campbell, and I think he was speaking about how, like, when you went against that worldview, you really literally believed you would burn, you know, like,
yeah,
if you're sinning against or transgressing the hierarchy, you would pay the consequences on the other side. It's strange, cuz you know, you're talking about language and the fundamentals of the universe and stuff. And then I, you know, of course we're talking about philosophy. And so it's interesting to think in terms of how, like, you know, David Foster Wallace too, like, they're creating these structures. So there's something that language does that doesn't necessarily behave in reality, where you create these paradoxes. I'm thinking of like Zeno's paradox, where there's a paradox in language, but the paradox doesn't exist in reality.
Right. But would you know that it doesn't exist in reality?
Well, if you were to walk to the wall, you would.
Oh, if you reach the target where the arrow hit.
Right, exactly.
Right, okay, I see.
But the whole idea of philosophy and how, like, it does seem like science does not provide anything to give. I mean, it does provide technology, but there's no meaning in that unless we utilize the technology to create a worldview to give people meaning.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine how we can reclaim that kind of meaning, you know, because science is just going further and further out into the universe, right? And our sort of impression of ourselves is we're just more and more and more peripheral, right? More and more just sort of random marginal beings, you know. it's really hard to kind of like find a sense of meaning with that being the kind of dominant paradigm.
There's the whole transhumanism angle, which I've never been very fond of. That
no,
yeah, the something interesting. So it's not the Asshole's Guide to Cinema, but the Pervert's Guide to Cinema.
Oh, by Zizek, yeah.
Yeah, and so it must have been about 10 years ago that I was interested. I think I may be a closeted communist a little bit. I mean, so like it must have been in my early sync days. I was really looking for a practical way, like how do you live in the world and not distress other people? How do we move towards, you know, like how do we behave in a way that doesn't harm other people, and how can we behave just, you know, how can our lives create good, you know? Like, this right, was something right. I was really interested in. It must have been about, you know, 2009, 2010, kind of, like, recycling and looking into, you know, not generating tons of waste and this whole thing. And I was looking both backwards and just thinking about lots of things. And now I think I've lost my way. Oh, but yeah, but about the same time, I was definitely looking at political structures and thinking about different philosophies. But I was revisiting Zizek recently. I even downloaded a book, and then I realized, you know what? I don't know that I like his books. I like to listen to him sniff and talk and tell his jokes.
Pull out his t-shirt.
Yeah. But I think he might be – so like I mentioned to SJ, I think as far as his clout as a public intellectual has gone down a lot, and part of it was like I think he supported Trump. I think what he does is he's not someone who's creating answers, but he's definitely like – he likes to stir the pot. Like that's
he is a philosopher, right? Like he's more concerned with the questions than the answers,
right? But as far as like a prescription, he's never gonna he says things and then people get really angry at him, like, you know, we should have a revolution, there should be bloodshed. But then when you actually, he says things in the abstract, in the philosophical realm that is not necessarily in reality. And right, then when you do come back to reality, if people are like, well, you know what that literally means is dead kids in the street or whatever it is. And then, But so I listened to this really fascinating debate between him and a guy named Will Self.
The author, the British author.
Yeah, and it was just... it was fun because this Will Self was really just relentless. Like he was not holding anything back, and so usually it's just Slavoj is just kind of grandstanding, and he's fun and he's an interesting character. But it was kind of interesting. But so anyway, the whole point of that is to say that it sounds like Slavoj Žižek may be advocating some kind of universal type governance system. The idea of nation states really doesn't make sense anymore. And to me that is fascinating because, you know, I've thought about that too. How do you create a world where there isn't like an other, like you know what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I've heard him say that too, like especially in regard to these these huge problems that we're facing in the world, including climate change and like population problems and mass poverty, etc., that there does need to be a system of like a more integrated system of global government to deal with these problems, because they're not at the national level anymore.
I think Joseph Campbell would advocate something like that too, or he did.
The problem with all of that is authority, right? Like as soon as you centralize anything, you put more power in the hands of fewer people, and their ability to abuse that power becomes greater and greater, and inevitably it does get abused, right?
I've gone back and forth with the idea of like government and governance, and I love like good city government, where you have these beautiful clean streets with, you know, where there's just order.
Mm.
You know, where
you should come to Japan.
But then I think, like, if you think about, like, I think about, I'm definitely a skittish individual, more Western in nature. Like if you think about like order, it's almost fascist, right? With stoplights and authority.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then you go to a place it's more like there's a law of nature that the people all understand. It's not necessarily an external authority. It is the intersection itself that dictates how one behaves through it. And no one dies every day, but somehow... Yeah.
Yeah, you see those videos of...
exactly.
On YouTube of... Indian intersections, like in the big cities in India, and I've been there, so I've witnessed this. And there's no lights or anything at all, and they just the traffic just kind of weaves in and out of each other, you know, like not only traffic but animals and pedestrians and everything.
But there's that's the idea of culture too. So there's a culture to that traffic that everyone understands.
Yeah, it's self-organization. I think you could have self-organization on a international level, right? Where people are dealing with problems without any sort of central authority. And that's kind of where I differ from Zizek and a lot of like authoritarian socialists like that. But I think there is a way to do it, like the kind of idea in Pynchon of the anarchist miracle, you know.
I think
that happens, it could happen and does happen on an international level. We don't need any sort of centralized authority, and centralized authority is the wrong way to go, I think, you know?
Well, but so like you also look at, you know, at that same intersection in whatever country it is where there's very little regulation, you look at the power lines and the cable TV and all the lights and, you know, the wires are in the street and they're all over the place. It's like there's something to be said to have like some kind of regulating body.
Well, there's other things involved too, right? There's the progress of the economy, which is accelerating everything, and then trying to throw that into a system of natural self-organization that puts everything into a real form of chaos. You know, where you do find wires jutting out into the streets and cows eating plastic and all kinds of stuff, you know. But so that's another thing, right? And so that's kind of my critique of capitalism, right? I think those two go together, and you can't have a critique against the state unless you have a critique against capitalism. So you could have self-organizing systems even on transnational levels if it wasn't based on this idea of infinite growth, right? And the idea of infinite growth comes from it's class politics. It's like infinite profits for the people at the top, you know? So I don't know. I'm in a weird position myself politically because I'm against the kind of authoritarian or even so-called democratic socialist, but I'm entirely against the kind of libertarians as well. You know, like you have to deal with capitalism first. This whole idea of infinite growth is what's killing us. You know?